I've had a couple of songs stuck in my head this week after I looked at our gospel reading for today. One was Love Hurts by the Everly Brothers, Don and Phil. Great songs, great harmonies, first recorded 54 years ago, and it seems to me just like 54 years. That's a long time. The song was actually written by Felice and Boudlow Bryant. They're a couple who wrote some of the Everlys' most beloved songs. They did Bye Bye Love and All I Have to Do Is Dream and others. And of course, Love Hurts was repopularized by a number of other recording artists. Now, I was thinking about that song, Love Hurts, because the lyrics tell a truth that we all know. Love inherently involves being in a state of vulnerability. And at times, it hurts to love. If you want to love, well, there's going to be some pain somewhere. And I suggest that we are seeing this in this first Sunday after Christmas. I mean, what a difference a week can make. Just 7 days ago, it was all angels and shepherds and mangers and visions of sugar plums. Okay, maybe I kind of inserted that last part into the story, but you get the idea. The account of the birth of Jesus, a tale we retold just 7 days ago, it's a really fine story. And for a great many of us, there's something soothing, something solid, something reassuring about this tale. Me, I delight in the Christmas story. I love all the festivities. We believe in an excessive Christmas in the Spencer house. Okay, maybe that's a little strong, but we certainly engage in a robust celebration of the occasion. Christmas is an important part of the yearly church cycle that grounds us in the Christian story. And so the first earworm I had this week was Love Hurts. And it's the Everly's version, because if I talk about the Nazareth version, it's going to get confusing. Huh? Some of you get this. Good. The second song was that last carol we just sang, O Little Town of Bethlehem. It's actually an ironic song to accompany today's Bible reading. I did some research on the carol, and I discovered that the tune was composed very, very quickly, at least according to Lewis Redner, who wrote the melody. The lyricist, the influential Episcopal priest and preacher, Phillips Brooks, he'd written it as a poem a few years after a trip to the Holy Land, a trip he made in 1865. And so in 1868, he asked Redner, after writing these lyrics, to quickly compose a tune so that it could be used at a Sunday school service that was coming up. He asked Redner on the Friday to have it ready for Sunday. Feel some pressure, John, yeah. And interestingly, it's subsequently become one of those carols that's kind of a standard, at least in the Western church. I think there's something peaceful about it, as the author addresses a kind of a personified Bethlehem. How still we see thee lie. Above thy deep and dreamless sleep, the silent stars go by. Yet in thy dark street shineth, in your dark streets, the everlasting light shines. The hopes and fears of all the years are met in you tonight, Bethlehem. So there's a gentleness and a peace in the picture that it creates in our minds. Now, I don't know the circumstances of Brooks' visit in 1865. Perhaps it was peaceful that year. But Bethlehem's history, the whole region's history for that matter, is not especially peaceable. And it remains a most conflicted place to this very day. Just after World War II, 85% of the population of Bethlehem was Christian. Today it's 15%. Movement of citizens is very, very difficult. And while there surely are a number of factors at play here, I think it's safe to say that it is a troubled community. It's a region that's known pain through all the years, and it continues to know pain. Just 11 miles to the north of Bethlehem, a few miles beyond Jerusalem, is a town called Ramah. At least there used to be. You heard it mentioned in our Bible reading this morning. The reference is a quote from the prophet Jeremiah, and that was more than 600 years before Jesus' birth. Remember, Israel was crushed first by the Assyrians and then by the Babylonians, and many were taken captive and they were transported to Babylon. So Ramah was known as a collection place, a location where the Babylonians gathered their captives before they shuffled them off to exile. It's also the spot where legend had it that the ancient patriarch Jacob, his wife Rachel, was reputed to have been buried there. And she becomes a personification of all the mothers of Israel. When it's described that she wept in her tomb at her children being carried off. So why was that reference made? How is Ramah connected to Bethlehem? Well, Matthew's making this link because something heartbreaking happened in Bethlehem. A little earlier in the second chapter of Matthew, we learned of the Magi's search for a newborn king, something they'd discerned by looking to the stars. And their journey logically takes them to the palace of Herod because, well, palaces are usually where you find kings. And when they didn't find him there, off they go to Bethlehem. Now, the problem here is Herod is now in on the story. He knows there's another king in the neighborhood, and Herod, he is paranoid. Paranoid about competition. And he has all the compassion of a great white shark. Herod the Great, as he was called, was a really wily and in many ways a nasty character. He indeed was a great builder. He significantly improved the temple in Jerusalem. And he did do some things to improve the life of his subjects. Sometimes his motives were good. But he was also utterly ruthless, which combined with his paranoia at being usurped, made him very dangerous to be around. When he assumed power in 37 BC, he had the members of the Sanhedrin, the Jewish religious court, he had them murdered along with several hundred other public officials. And being family was no asset. The old saying was that it was better to be Herod's sow than to be his son. He had multiple wives and children, and a number of his sons he had executed because of his suspicion that they were planning on seizing power. One, even just a few days before Herod himself died. And fearing that there wasn't going to be anyone who might mourn him, he tried, unsuccessfully I might add, but he did try to have a number of the prominent Jerusalem leaders murdered when he died. So while there'd be at least some grief in the city, even if it wasn't the loss of Herod the Great. So this is the character whom the Magi visited. Magi who naively let slip that they were looking for a newborn king. And so does it surprise any of us that as soon as they left his office, he ordered that all the male babies aged 2 and under in Bethlehem be put to the sword? Hardly. It makes nothing but terrible sense that he tried to do that because he tolerated no competition. And so the troops were dispatched to Bethlehem, and historians estimate 10, 20, maybe 30 innocent children were put to death. In the tradition of the church, those children are remembered, though they were unaware of this, they're remembered as being the first martyrs for Christ. It's such a marked contrast to the birth story. It's a disturbing story to encounter coming so fast on the heels of, while mortals sleep, the angels keep their watch of wondering love. Bethlehem, this place of joy, and now a place of agony. So what do we make of that? Let me suggest a few things. First of all, babies are dangerous. I know it probably sounds a little strange to say that. On one level, these tiny little lives don't seem especially threatening. But when you stop to think about it, babies are often perceived as dangerous. They take your heart. They make you vulnerable to pain. They change lives. They demand. They humble. They reveal truth. Ask King David. Truly, one of the most wonderful and most terrifying things in the world is to hear the statement, "There's a baby on the way." Still changing my life, agonizing and delighting decades later. But babies, they destabilize powerfully. And their presence can cause us to do all manner of things to protect ourselves from the danger that they pose. Jewish babies, Ukrainian babies, Armenian babies, Chinese babies. That threatening list is long, and it continues to this very day all around the world. Babies are dangerous. Actually, people are dangerous. And sometimes just the smartest thing to do is kill them because, well, that's what the world tells us. Second thought. As much as we try to tell ourselves otherwise, we live in a really hard world. We just have to look back on the news of the last couple of weeks, and we can see all sorts of painful stuff, even as recently as last night. Illness, death, loss, grief, murder, betrayal. Is it worse than previous years? I doubt it. I don't see it as especially better. For all the advances we see in our world, for all the human progress and all the technological marvels that we enjoy, for all our systems and attempts to bring order and peace to the world we live in, it still ain't pretty. Bethlehem was a place of birth, and it was a place of death most foul. It was a place of hope, and as a result of that hope, was seen as a source of a threat to the established order. Jesus is rarely ever received well by those in power. Ironically, Herod wasn't wrong. He was actually right in sensing that Jesus was a danger. Not so much to him, of course, but it wasn't too long before he was really upsetting the order of things. Love does that. Herod was just the first to notice. And since then, Herod and his successors have been pushing back, doing their best in doing the worst. And following Jesus will eventually make that reality clear in some way. Eventually, you will be required to decide who you're with. Is it Jesus or is it with Herod? This always happens to those who claim Jesus as Lord. It will always happen. Who are you with? It'll probably happen subtly. You might not even know that you're being asked whose side you're on, but it will happen, because that's simply been our story for the last 2,000 years. Yes, Bethlehem is a place in Israel, but I would also suggest that it is a place in the human heart. Something will happen, and you'll suddenly realize that you are in Bethlehem, that something is playing out within you, and that there is a cost to this Jesus thing. Our world is hard. Things are by no means fair. And here, a mere 7 days after the birth in Bethlehem, we're being reminded that discipleship, living as Jesus' people, is not something that will come easy. It won't when you live in Bethlehem. Because it's a hard place. Which is assuredly why Jesus, the embodiment of love, was first revealed to us there. When we Christians claim God as love, we aren't just saying that God's someone who loves, who's good, who's compassionate and generally nice, but that love is God's essential character. You want to know what love looks like? Then look at Jesus. And as the song goes, love, well, love hurts. Real love always involves risk, the possibility of failure, the possibility of pain. It's a paradox, but love is inextricably tied up with pain. And when Jesus, the embodiment of love, moved into our district, as we celebrated last Saturday night and last Sunday morning here and in countless other places, well, it's no surprise that the hardness of the world, the pain of the world, the fallen nature of humanity was quickly revealed. O Holy Child of Bethlehem, descend on us, we pray. Cast out our sin and enter in. Be born in us today. Perfect love in Bethlehem is going to reveal much that is imperfect in Bethlehem. He will reveal imperfection within us and imperfection in what's around us. See, Herod's not going to give up without a fight. He never does. He's sure not doing so in my life. But then again, nor will the one who came to save us all. For the dear Christ has entered in, has come to Bethlehem, has come into us. Amen.